and
start.
Yep. I think. Oh, Zach's
sorry,
gonna.
I
it's okay.
Just realized I left. Brain, so I'm just. I've.
Hold on one second, Brian. We're just gonna get a couple things organized here. Are you typing and driving?
No, I am just driving.
It sounded like somebody was typing.
I would never do that. So if you pick up any background noise from me, just let me know and I'll mute my phone unless I want to say something.
So far it's not too loud, so that's good.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to go live.
You ready, Zach? All right.
You're live.
Okay, good afternoon. This is Julie Fedorchak. I am filling in for our chairman, Randy Chrisman, who is on the road today, and he has actually recused himself from this case. So it is case number PU-17-97. We have a work session on the Senex pipeline proposal for a new pipeline in North Dakota. And on the phone, calling from the road also, is Commissioner Brian Crotchis. And with me in the room are our attorney, Zach Pelham, and a staff person, Patrick Fawn, head of the Public Utilities Division. And so we have had one work session on this. Brian, do you have any opening comments?
I do not.
Okay, we'll just jump right in then. We have had one work session on this already and talked through a few different issues. And I think that the we had some information that we were kind of tasking our attorney to dig up with the company and staff as well. And so I think that they probably have some information to report back. And with that, I'll just kick it back to Zach, and you can kind of walk through the issues that we came up with last time and any others that have since arisen, Zach.
All right. Thank you. Hello, Commissioner Crotchis. If you can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. So, I think you covered it quite well, Commissioner Fedorchak. There are there are several questions that the commission had after the last work session. Some of maybe the easier ones to deal with, I'll maybe go through first. There was a question as far as the location of valves 2 and 3 and the worst case scenario for that particular area, and the reason why those valves were located where they were at. And as suspected, I'd speculated that probably if you shortened or the distance between the 2 and 3, then it would lengthen the distance between valves 3 and 4 or something, which would potentially impact the worst case scenario. The company indicated that they chose those two particular locations based on studies that are accepted in the industry, and that the location of those particular valves were chosen, one for the topography area of those locations were chosen just because of difficult terrain, as well as the proximity of electrical service, so that they could be electronically closed if an emergency situation. So those I think that answers the question on that. One of the questions, I think it was Commissioner Crotchis had a question as far as one of the exhibits, a late filed exhibit, as far as looked maybe like a road or some type of clearing, and the answer to that is what that was is the company believes that is a existing Hess pipeline. So that answers, I think, that particular question. The main questions that we had, I think, that came up aside from, I'll give you an update on probably first before we get into the cut and cover or the HDD drilling issues, had to do with the status of easement acquisitions. I asked for an update from the company, which they provided to me today. As of today, Senex was at 64.2% of acquired easements from landowners, and which is 63% based on mileage. So there is some improvement from that standpoint. They obviously still have a little bit of ways to go on easement acquisitions. As to particular individuals who testified at the hearing, the company has indicated that as to Mr. Marshall, that there is an agreement on an acceptable reroute, but they're still negotiating the terms of the easement. So there's been some progress reached with that individual. It's Mr. Augie.
Hold on 1 second on that.
Yes.
Can you? I just pulled up my notes on him, Mr. Marshall. He was the one that had some property adjacent that he wanted to develop. So can you tell me again, what did the company say in regards to him?
They've indicated to me that they have reached a, you know, an agreement in principle, but they're working on reducing it to writing.
Okay.
So they've it's not an agreement, but they believe
signed.
It hasn't been signed, and that's what they need to. That's what they're working on right now.
Okay.
But they believe that that will be coming with Mr. Marshall.
Okay. Good.
With Mr. Haugie, he's a gentleman that would not sign survey permission. They being the company, are still in discussions with him, but they've also had to involve neighbors because any potential reroute would potentially move the line out of Mr. Haugie's property onto a neighbor's. And what they're working on apparently now is a reroute that would potentially, again, this is not in writing and nothing has been signed or agreed on, and they continue to work with Mr. Haugie as well as presumably the neighbors, the adjacent neighbors on the current proposed route, that a reroute would potentially partially go through Mr. Haugie's land and partially through the neighbors. So the company is working on resolving that particular issue with that particular landowner, but nothing has been resolved at this point as to Mr. Haugie.
Okay.
Nichols, that is the reroute that he's proposing, is that would go through a large wetland and onto a neighbor's property. The indication from the company as to the status of that is it's really kind of a non-starter as far as potential reroutes in that particular area. They haven't said that they've stopped talking to him, but that's the challenge. There is what's being proposed is an area into a large wetland, which, as you know, that has other considerations in there as well.
What was the other piece of that one? Would impact a wetland, and there was one other
part. And it would go onto a neighbor's property as well. So it would impact a landowner that is not currently on the project as proposed. And you'll recall the Strobeck family, they're representing.
Zach, one more thing on that, Nichols. My notes say that the current route would wreck a gravel potential gravel site.
I think that's what his concern is.
Yeah.
And whether or not, I can't sit here and tell you whether or not that would potentially wreck it or wouldn't wreck it. Mm-hmm. It might impact it, I suppose. At the same time, presumably there, it's not one of the qualifications that we're looking at in a siting permit. It probably, I would guess, would be a basis for negotiations of a private easement with them, but it's not something that, in my opinion, that we really should get involved in with a private gravel development or non-development in the future.
And if they had to, just this is, again, not our concern, but I'm just interested in for my own information. Do you know, in a condemnation proceeding, do they consider things such as that? Future economic value?
I think certainly a landowner would probably bring that up as far as the value of that. And I don't know one way or the other if any condemnation proceedings have been brought at this time. I don't think that they have. I know in the past I specifically asked, Mr. Biel is nodding, no condemnation actions have been brought on any of the remaining landowners that haven't signed easements on. But certainly it's something that a landowner could argue to a court as far as the value of the property being quote-unquote taken.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
And the last individual, I guess it's a family here, the Strobeck family, you'll recall, represented by Mr. Sheldon Smith, and provided a reroute map and some testimony. The company reports that they haven't reached an agreement with them, but they are continuing to negotiate with them. So there really isn't a change, I don't think, from the last time I reported to you at the last work session on that particular tract of land.
All right. Thank you.
As far as the geological unstable areas, there's three areas, and there was a question as far as whether or not one of the exhibits, I think it was Exhibit 26, if I'm not mistaken, whether or not there were any other geologically unstable areas other than the three that were outlined in the letter from the expert from the company. And the company reports that no, those are the only three areas of geologically unstable areas on this project route. And the company is proposing and is requesting specifically to do the cut-cover method rather than the HDD method. And in discussing this with the company representatives, their attorney, after the last work session, was explained to me that, you know, again, the not to be overly repetitive here, but again, the expert that I think it was Terracon opined that the cut and cover method could be done. If done properly, would not in the event of a slide in that particular area, it would be below the slip and it would not impact the pipeline. They proposed to use best management practices and proper trenching techniques to go about that. So the company is continuing its request to have the three particular geologic unstable areas, the pipeline installed in that area using the cut and cover method. It did get a little bit of an update today. From a Senex engineer conveyed through Senex's attorney, who indicated, and I'll just read it, the water control measures that are utilized in pipeline construction to prevent erosion and washout of the soils within sloping trenches include trench breakers to control excessive amounts of water infiltration that might otherwise destabilize the replaced and recompacted trench soil material, and the use of water bars to divert water away from the trench line onto undisturbed vegetative areas. It's this particular engineer's belief that based on the geotechnical consultant's recommendations, which we have, that Senex's pipeline can be placed at their suggested depth and be safe from exposure in the event of a slide that is below the, quote, slip plane, end quote, of any potentially unstable material. A question was asked, I believe, by you, Commissioner Fedorchak, as far as whether or not there would be potentially a limitation on the construction right-of-way, just because anytime native prairie is removed, it's very difficult for it to regrow. It's my understanding that the company would be able to do the construction that are with a 75-foot construction right-of-way, and that's what they've indicated to me.
I was just talking about in the geologically unstable.
I think that's areas. Specifically in the geologically unstable areas, 75 feet.
Well, that's not at all what I was talking about. I mean, this is a totally different method, not just trying to inch it in, just like really going just as narrow as possible.
And I think that's the width that would be, in their view, the narrowest possible
for
these particular areas.
Okay.
And that's the response I got. So
right, yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously, there is the possibility for HDD. We talked a little bit about, the cost concerns at the last work session being quite a bit more expensive. It can be done. It can be done in their opinion, in their expert's opinion, using the cut and cover method as well.
Mm-hmm. The point, and I'm saying this because I know they're here and listening, the point of narrowing the easement width wasn't just to save Native Prairie. It's to allow the Native Prairie to help reduce the impact of the geologically unstable areas.
Yes.
So it doesn't just, I'm not trying to save Native Prairie, although I do like saving Native Prairie, but it has the effect of minimizing the erosion, which is what we're concerned about in that in this particular area and what they're seeking to get waivers on.
Right.
So.
And as far as the no reasonable alternative, there's a question as to that, and the company has responded. And looking back in the testimony, the company indicated that, you know, these are the three areas on this project that they simply, if they go one way or the other way, they would run into similar, if not, you know, potentially worse types of situations with, you know, rough terrain, topography that is, you know, more incline, decline than, you know, certainly in the Red River Valley or something like mm-hmm. that. So, I mean, that's essentially what they've indicated to me in following up and looking back at the record on the two hearing dates that we had. That was the indication that I received is there just simply isn't in their mind a feasible alternative around, because if they go one way, it would either impact potentially more landowners or it would potentially be in similar areas where they would be quote unquote in the same boat as they are potentially now. So they have studied it. They have indicated that these are the only three areas on this entire route that had the geologic unstable areas and are proposing what they are proposing on this.
So we would be finding essentially that there is no reasonable alternative to impacting these geologically unstable areas, and the construction methods they're proposing are minimizing the impact. Are the most they can do to minimize the impact, or enough to minimize the impact? I mean,
I think it's satisfactorily,
not the most.
Satisfactorily minimized, because, I mean, quite frankly, I mean, look, I mean, and Pat can probably chime in. I mean, the HDD is sort of the gold standard. At the same time, though, I don't, from what I understand in what the company has presented, both in documents and in discussions, is that the cut and cover method is an accepted method that their engineering and their review have indicated is acceptable. You know, I don't know if we want to get into the better or best type of analysis. I don't know if that's necessarily our role to do that. I think if we had something that would be pointing towards, look, cut and cover is just not acceptable in this particular area, then we'd probably be looking at HDD. But there isn't anything that I'm aware of that is in the record that would indicate that the cut and cover method is not an otherwise acceptable method.
Pat,
how's that for a qualification?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, what Zach said is true. The engineering firm that studied it said this is an acceptable method. The response we got about erosion control indicated two methods, and one method was diverting the water as it runs down the slope, diverting it off to the sides, and the other method was the trench barrier method. And I know what that is. It's, you know, where I think they put material in the trench perpendicular to the trench, you know, like in the, mm-hmm. at the 90 degree angles with the pipe, and that will reduce the flow rate of the water that could potentially erode the area. And we don't have a lot of detail on that. I looked in the construction practices manual that they had filed with the application. It doesn't have a detailed drawing, for example, of how they would do the barrier, trench barriers. It doesn't talk about the material of it, and doesn't talk about the use of it in these areas. But I was thinking that that for the commissioner's sake, if we were to go ahead and allow them to use this method, this cut and cover, it could provide more information about the trench barrier method.
Mm-hmm. and how it works.
And how it works so that we would know that they were following, you know, what their engineers say would work the best.
So you're suggesting they provide some
I would like to see that they provide something there, yeah.
What are you thinking? Like during construction or what kind of a reporting mechanism are you looking at?
Well, sort of like what they have provided us for other construction practices, best practices, they have that manual. It just doesn't include this particular item.
Okay. So adding more
a supplement
about
to that.
Yeah. I see.
And the detail, there are detailed drawings on how they do other things like water diversion.
Sure.
This would be another detail schematic about how they use the trench.
And I think that should be detailed in any order, quite frankly. And, you know, to get that information to supplement as to BMPs on that particular method, if that, in fact, is a method that is anticipated to be used, so that we'd have something in the order saying that this is how we're going to do it.
Okay.
And we can point to something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense. All right.
And I think that I don't know that the engineering firm recommended that, but it was recommended by the company. And so it would be good to know that the engineering firm thought it was a good way to do it, too.
Okay. So maybe they provide the information?
They could. The company could with with some kind of a sign-off or an agreement or acknowledgement by the engineering firm that this really would work.
Sure. Okay.
And do a good job.
All right. What did we have anything else? I think that
I didn't have anything else. I don't think I'm missing anything, Pat. I don't know if you had anything else on your notes.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Brian, do you have any questions or concerns that you want?
Just one question. Can you remind me, or do we know in the three areas where we're talking minimizing the construction technique, where they stand in terms of easements with the landowners affected?
So whether or not they have the easements on the sites that are geologically unstable?
Right.
I don't know that we've ever actually looked at that. That's a good question. I think
for some reason I'm thinking that had been discussed, but I'm not remembering definitively, Commissioner, as to whether or not those have been obtained. But I can certainly find out, and we can ask the company that.
Okay, good. The timeline seems to be, they don't seem real concerned about this timeline. Do we have any information on
that? I think that the timeline is really essentially been effectively, they've already indicated they're not going to do major winter construction. They've indicated that they want to do some preparatory work, but it would not involve winter construction.
Mm-hmm.
We had quite a bit of discussion on that at the hearings, and the company provided some documents indicating how they would do it if they were going to do it. But since that time, they've indicated to me that winter construction is not contemplated.
Yeah.
But they do still want to go ahead and get a permit so that they can start doing construction in the spring.
Okay. And do they have a requirement for a core permit?
I think if they do. And I don't think that they do. I think they fit under the nationwide 12 permit.
Don't they cross?
But they will
over in, like, the Yellowstone, the Missouri, over in Montana.
That's in Montana, and that's not something that we're not necessarily looking at here. But if they were to need a permit, then of course that they're going to need to have that in place, and our order would cover, you know, a catch-all, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Any permits that are required, they would obviously have to have in advance of starting any construction. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that they have all the permits that are required, or would obtain them before doing the construction.
Okay, let me, Zach. I know that we have always handled it that way in the past, where you have to get all the permits, and I'm not suggesting we deviate from that.
Mm-hmm.
But what is our obligation, or what would be the common sense approach, knowing what we know since Dakota Access and what a huge issue that became with the Corps permit, and could have potentially resulted in a pipeline being half built in our state?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a valid question.
Do we have some responsibility to require some progress report from the company on that permit and when they expect to get it, et cetera, before we give them a permit that allows them to start constructing in our state?
It's somewhat of a chicken or the egg type scenario, Commissioner, I think, because there are a wide variety of permits. This is one of the permits that the company needs. The company takes the financial risk in the sense that, under the hypothetical, if, you know, the Corps in the Dakota Access case wouldn't have granted the river crossing, then Dakota Access would have spent millions of dollars in constructing mm-hmm. a pipeline. Granted, then what do we do to finish it off? They'd still have all of the requirements for reclamation, even if the pipeline never went live, and it would be, you know, in the ground, I suppose. And under that hypothetical, we would obviously look at potential ways to mitigate issues for particular landowners. But I think in this particular case, I will go back and double check. But there were not any coming to my mind any permits that that the company would likely not be able to obtain at this point, and it's my recollection that they have obtained essentially the major permits. But I will go back and double check. I know that the one easement that they don't have signed is with the North Dakota Trust Department, mm-hmm. land department, because they required approximately 90% of easement acquisition before they'll enter an easement. But I will go back and double check, and I will also make sure and double check and triple check really the order and ensure that that it contains language, and quite sure that it does, saying that that the company is representing that has all the necessary permits in order to do the construction.
Well, and just for myself, I'm thinking hard about some of those permits and the impact that it has on, what's the proper order for orderly development?
Mm-hmm.
Because yes, the company, and they always are obligated to complete the reclamation, et cetera, but if a company goes belly up because a project goes south, there's not a lot of protection there for the landowners.
No, there isn't. And going belly up is possible with any, and I know you're not, I know you're not, and it's a valid point to make. Here, though, we're talking about a company that's been around for quite some time.
Right.
That's a responsible corporate entity that is a known commodity. Now, at the same time, you're right. You're absolutely right to ask the question, because we can't assume anything about any company. So I think it's fine to have the discussion, but I think that the concern is lessened just because of the company that we are dealing with. is a company that's committed to the state of North Dakota. It has been a longtime corporate citizen of the state of North Dakota. And quite frankly, if something were to be problematic, you know, they have a lot of interests in North Dakota as a corporation, and would unlikely be wanting to have much bad publicity, bad press in that type of situation. But you're absolutely right to ask the questions, and I think it's certainly worth a discussion in having that at a work session.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's see where they're at with the core permit, and we can all be thinking about, you know, from a procedural standpoint, how we want to approach those and what we want to do in lieu of what we learned can happen with federal permits to protect the folks in our state mm-hmm. from a project that gets underway without one and may come into a stumbling block. So just, I think we just need to think about that, how what's the best way to handle it.
No, I think you're on the right, you're absolutely on the right track. You know, because with Dakota Access, I mean, Energy Transfers is a huge company, and they experience a phenomenon that really they didn't see coming. Very few people probably could legitimately claim that they saw it coming.
Yeah. Okay, so thanks for the good update on the folks with the concerns, the landowners, and where the company is. And it sounds like they made some progress with some of them. That's good. The lack of the progress on the easements is probably the strongest indicator to me that the company is not, you know, really pushing hard to get this thing in the ground, because it's not our process that's slowing them down. They don't have the easements. So I'd like to keep watching that and the easement side of things, and hopefully those come along in a stronger pace, and then we'll get an update on the core permit and talk about the geographically unstable areas a little bit after we see the filings on their procedures. But it sounds like we're going towards accepting what they're proposing there, and with a little bit more information on some of their specific BMPs.
Fair enough. Understood.
Brian, do you have anything else?
I do not, no. Appreciate the information.
All right. Well, then, unless either of you have more to add, this work session on case number PU-17-97 is complete. Thank you. Drive safe, Brian.
All right. Thank you.